Welcome to the Foolish Adventure Show, where guru hype is banned, lifetime value of a customer is king, and the internet business has replaced the J-O-B as the path to financial success and personal freedom. Now, here's straight talk about making a living online with your host, Tim Conley.
Welcome to another episode of the Foolish Adventure Show. I'm your host, Tim Conley, and I've got a very special guest here, Mr. Derek Sivers of CD Baby fame, who had sold his company in 2008, which we're not actually going to talk about here. There's plenty of interviews of Derek out there about the rise and the sale of CD Baby, but what we're going to talk about is the time between the sale and now. Where this is going to be more of a mindset episode and not a how-to episode. So, what's up, Derek?
Hey, Tim. What's funny is that when I left CD Baby, when I sold CD Baby, I thought that my greatest hits were behind me. You know, like somebody who had a hit single in the 80s and that's all they will ever be known for. So I thought it would go on to my gravestone. You know, here lies Derek Sivers. He made CD Baby and that's about it. What's funny is that when I spoke at all the TED conferences a year after I sold CD Baby, now I think I'm actually more known for that. Like as I just go around the world, everybody's like, hey, you're that like dancing first follower, dancing leadership guy from TED. Rock on, dude. And then people will sometimes say, so like, what do you do besides speak at TED? And that's all they know me for now.
Okay. So the sale happened in
2008.
Mid-2008, right? And from some of the stuff that I'd heard, you just wanted to decompress from that. So where did you go? Like, what happened to Derek after the sale?
I don't know if it's decompress as much as de-brainwash or... I wanted to change my operating system.
Okay.
I think all of us have a way that we do things. You know, say when you're like a... teenager or early 20s or whatever, you're constantly learning new things and growing and changing everything and deciding what your major is going to be, then going out into the world and getting jobs and doing things and changing wildly all the time. And then people often hit a point in their 30s or so where they just kind of say, well, this is who I am. This is the way I do things.
Oh, that just gives me shivers. They're like, oh, that doesn't feel good at all.
Well, you know, it's like, well, this is the way I like my eggs. This is the kind of music I like. This is my favorite team. This is where I live. This is what kind of person I am. I'm a social person, or I enjoy a beer on a Friday, or this is who I am. And people get that weird kind of stuck thing. And here's a version of that in the music business, is that I would go to these music conferences and I'd be invited to speak on a panel. It's always a panel. And the moderator would ask, what is the future of the music business? And the guy who's in the business of selling MP3s would say, the business, you know, the future is selling MP3s. People want to buy MP3s, whatever. And the guy who's in the business of streaming radio would say, people don't want MP3s. People just want to turn on the radio, but have it worldwide and all the reasons. And then they turn to me and I'm business of selling CDs and distributing things. And so they'd expect me to say that the future is that. But all I could say is like, look, nobody knows the future. Nobody. Like Ben Bernanke doesn't know the future of the world economy and he controls it. You know, like even the people that control the stuff don't know it. The record labels don't know the future of the music industry and they somewhat control it. Nobody knows. And anybody who claims to know is full of shit and not to be trusted because they're obviously not thinking clearly or being honest if they claim to know what the future is, because they don't. So if they're opening their mouth and telling you what the future is, they're lying. They're not being honest. Or if they think they know, then they've deluded themselves and they're not thinking clearly, right? So I felt that at CD Baby, I had been seeing the world through one point of view for 10 years. I was immersed in my world of independent musicians mailing me a box of CDs directly and having me sell the physical CDs and distribute the digital files off to iTunes, Amazon, Napster, Rhapsody, etc. And that was my whole world for 10 years. I was very kind of like head down at work on that. The day I sold CD Baby, I went to sleep that night with an empty head and a big smile. I was like, wow, 10 years of my life, I'm done. I've moved on. It was like graduation day, right? Like, wow, I just finished. I went to sleep that night just like so empty-headed. And then I woke up the next day, had breakfast, and by lunch, I had a great idea for my next company. And I started sketching it out. It was called Muckwork. It was going to be this service firm, this like professional network of assistants that are already pre-trained to help musicians with all the things that musicians need help with, so that musicians don't need to kind of micromanage them. They can just dump their problems on us and we'll take care of it. And I was so excited about this idea that I immediately, like that day, it was January 18th is the day that I had the agreement to sell CD Baby. January 19th is the day that I woke up and had the Muckwork idea. And it's kind of cute that you can see, like, if you do the who is on the domain name, you can see that everything was like registered on January 19th, the day I had the idea. Programming and coding, I registered the domain name, I did all the programming, I worked on that for a few months, I even hired a manager, and I was just about to launch it. And then I had the feeling that I haven't yet changed my operating system. If I do this, it's going to be like CD Baby Part 2, like my life will not change. Same guy doing the same thing in the same way, but just with a different company name over my head. You know, I'm too into the idea of personal growth and development to do something like that. Like, so I kind of just quickly looked at my situation kind of before charging people's credit cards and beginning. Once somebody pays me the first dollar, I'm on the hook to deliver. And wait a second, I don't know if I want that yet. So that's when I kind of intentionally put the brakes on it. I let go of the manager I hired. Luckily, he'd only been working for me for a few weeks, so it wasn't no hard feelings. And I lifted my head up. You know, I often think of life as having different phases. That sometimes you're just head down and just working. And then sometimes lift your head up and look around and see what's up.
So when you did this, lifting your head up and taking a look around, you know, doing a complete operating system reboot would be pretty difficult for any human because, you know, we're so ingrained in our culture, our language, and sometimes even dictates our behaviors. And to do like a complete reboot, like what did you start with?
Reading lots of books and lots of nonfiction books, particularly a lot about psychology, behavioral economics, the studies of happiness, which is a fascinating idea. I'd like to study it directly, like learning what makes people happy and taking it to heart. You know, there's a kind of a cognitive fallacy that we all have where we think that statistics don't apply to us. When you hear 9 out of 10 people, blah, 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 you think, huh, well, I'm that 1 out of 10. You know, we all have that, right? Like 90% of people think that they are better than average drivers.
Right.
People asked in a hospital, in a cancer ward at a hospital, 95% of cancer patients say that they are in better health than most cancer patients. So it's amazing to think that, well, 45% of them are wrong. Like half the people that think they are better than average drivers are wrong. They're actually worse than average drivers. And then having to look at myself through this new fact, I think this is what I mean about like changing your operating system is taking in new knowledge and actually living by it, applying it, not just reading it and going, huh, it's interesting. back to my normal way of doing things.
So to be able to apply that, so let's take the happiness because I find that very interesting because we all have concepts of what's going to make us happy.
Yes.
Even while we're not currently happy. So we have that. So when you read something about how you can be happy, the act of being happy, how do you put that into your life? And this is from somebody who's now technically retired, right? What did you do that you could make use of that knowledge, build a framework or just sit back and think happy thoughts?
I guess that's where your personal preferences come in. Like even in Buddhism, say, like, I never understood that thing of people who just sit in a temple on top of a mountain or on under the Bodhi tree or something and just sit there and smile. That's not enough for me because I'd feel useless in the world if I'm just sitting there being happy. What's amazing is just a couple months ago, I went to Thailand. I didn't even realize there was such a thing as active Buddhism. I'm not an expert at this, but apparently there is a whole chunk of people that believe in applied Buddhism, like this idea of be happy and go out and do things that improve the world. Like it's not enough to just sit there and be happy and meditate. Like, yes, meditate, find your peace, and then go out and make the world a better place. So that's the one that appealed to me more, but I felt like I needed to kind of shatter my habits. So my little mini slogan was to wherever you used to say yes, say no, wherever you used to say no, say yes, kind of reversing all of the things that you used to do and just trying the opposite.
I want everybody that's listening to actually think about that right now. Think about what it would feel like to actually say yes to something that you would normally say no to. I guarantee you there's going to be a twinge of fear, because that's scary as can be.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's the whole point. It's almost like if you're not scared, you're doing something wrong. The whole point is to almost find the fear. I mean, I've had this slogan ever since I was a teenager, like, whatever scares you, go do it. And I use that. I would use that even on the little micro level. You know, you see the gorgeous girl across the room, and I'm like, you're like terrified to talk to her. I'm like, oh, whatever scares you, go do it. Here we go. And I would just walk up to the girl that intimidates me and say hello. And then, of course, you know, she's wonderful or not, but whatever it is, you walk away like no longer scared.
Right.
And I just have that approach through life. I think whatever scares you, go do it, because then it won't scare you anymore. I had never had an interest in traveling. I had never had an interest in anything but working. I was absolutely, from the age of 14 until 38, I was just a workaholic. In college, my nickname was the robot. The guys would tease me that I wouldn't even join them for dinner. The cafeteria, you know, had the free meals, and I went to Berklee School of Music, and everybody would like stop for an hour at 6 o'clock and hang out and eat whatever the cafeteria food was. And I would just breeze through in there, and I'd quickly slap some peanut butter and jam on some bread and grab some carrot sticks and throw it in my bag and head back up to the practice room. And they're like, dude, come on, man, hang out. I'm like, I don't want to hang out. I got to work. I got to practice. And, you know, I was always the first guy in the practice rooms in the morning and the last guy there at night. And everybody was like going out to parties on the weekend. And I would take that opportunity to, you know, read next year's assignment and do my homework in advance or whatever. And I was just that guy that would get teased for never relaxing. So to me, even the idea of like going to India for a month and walking around and experiencing it was like so against my grain, you know, that's not me. That's not what I do. So therefore that's what I need to do. You know, then there were a bunch of examples like that. You know, I just did a bunch of things that were not me, as part of in the name of kind of learning and growing and experiencing new things. The most obvious one that people point at is that my wife, you know, I met this gorgeous girl in New York City when I was there, and she was born in India, grew up in a Muslim family, and we had only been together a few months when I said, hey, come out to California with me. Let me get you out of New York City. Come hang out with me there. Because that's where I live. That's my place. And she said, well, I can't, you know, my mom still thinks I'm a virgin. I can't go with you unless we're married. I was like, married, huh? I could do that. So, yeah, we had a Muslim wedding. And I, even to make her parents happy, I said a few syllables here. In fact, for the sake of an interesting interview, I Googled how to convert to Islam. And apparently all you have to do is say these two sentences. I just memorized them phonetically. It's just, Ashhadu anna ilaha illallah, Ashhadu anna Muhammad Rasulallah. You say that in front of another Muslim and you have now converted. That's it. And so I read that. I was like, okay, I can do that. And I'm like cracking up like, oh my God, I'm going to convert to Islam. This is ridiculous. I was like, okay, here we go. In the name of changing my operating system. It's not like I'm going to actually adopt new beliefs or anything like that, but the change for me there was actually doing something that is not me to make someone else happy. I had never done that. I'm a California kid. I had always been so proudly, defiantly individualistic. I only do things for me, always the rebel. So the idea of even just like having that understanding, like this would make her parents very happy if I say these two sentences. It would let them tell the relatives back in India that their daughter had a proper Muslim wedding. Means nothing to me. It means everything to them. So here we go.
That's something I've always had a problem with, is doing things that for some reason I'm against, right? It doesn't mean anything to me, so therefore I shouldn't do it. And that is something I've struggled with, is opening up and allowing other people's feelings to actually get into my life. And that is something that I still struggle with today, because I don't actually see myself as actually that empathetic to look at, oh, you know, what would this really mean to someone else? And even further for you, for your wife, yeah, you can understand for her, but why that extra layer, you know, the family, and then even further afield to family back home. And for me, that's always been a struggle.
I guess this is what fiction is good at. I don't read a lot of fiction books, but I do watch a lot of movies. And when done right, the whole idea is to help you get into somebody else's head, really, and understand their thought process. Well, I guess, yeah, when fiction is done kind of deeply and done well, I guess this is where books often excel beyond movies that need to keep things kind of short and entertaining, is this idea of really getting into someone else's head. Like, I don't know right now whether you consider yourself liberal or conservative, but what's fascinating is that all the places I lived were just extremely liberal. I lived in New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, you know, all of the bluest parts of the bluest states, right? Then it was kind of cool, like starting to have friends that were extremely conservative and even going on the whole kind of, you know, Obama birther kind of thing. Yeah, well, show me the certificate. And having those people actually be friends of mine that I love and care about was kind of fascinating to get into a whole different, because it's not just about the president. It's like a whole different worldview of the way things should be. And getting back to traditional values and all that, whereas I'm always trying to get rid of traditional values. And how do you even like stay dear friends with somebody that looks at the world in a different way? Well, you get into their head. I guess we all have different sides to ourselves, right? Like even if you're 99% a certain way, like say introvert, extrovert or something, most people will say like, well, I'm kind of both. Well, I'm mostly introvert, but sometimes I like to go out and be with lots of people. Well, it's kind of like that. Like you can understand that the other way of looking at things, even if it's a smaller part of
right.
you. Anyway, I guess now's a good time to transition into talking about the kind of world traveling thing.
Yeah, because having a worldview and having it changed, that was something that impacted me is when I left home. I couldn't wait to leave home. I grew up in rural Southern Illinois, and I knew that the world was awesome because I could see it on TV.
And then you found out you were allowed to leave.
Yeah. But I grew up really not knowing how to leave. And my only thought was, oh, I'll join the military. And so I looked around and I looked at what was available for military service. And I was like, okay, I don't want to be on the front line. So that's Marines and Army out. I don't want to be stuck on a ship with a bunch of dudes for 6 months because I like the ladies a little too much. And back then, there were very few women deployed on the ship. So I didn't want to do that. And didn't want to join the Coast Guard because, well, that wouldn't get me overseas to a certain extent. And I didn't want to be involved in the drug war because that's pretty dangerous living too. And so that left the Air Force. So I joined the Air Force to travel the world. And they sent me to Texas and then to Arizona. And I had to travel on my own dime. But one of the great things that really helped me out was I grew up in a very racist area of Southern Illinois called Southern Illinois.
Wow.
And it was awesome because I always knew there was something wrong with racism. I didn't know what it was, but I always knew there was something wrong with it. And then I got into the military and it was fantastic because it was like, oh, I met the very first Puerto Rican man I'd ever known. And he was in the bunk just a couple of bunks away from me. Met first Filipino man ever. And being able to become very close friends with blacks, Hispanics, Asians, it was amazing. It was one of the most eye-opening experiences of my life. And that really rebooted my operating system because I knew mine was kind of broken. And then I got into that one and the military said, oh, no, you're not going to act like that. That is unacceptable behavior in this environment. And it was amazing. I loved it. And so then world travel just really broke some of the cultural scripts that I had been ingrained with growing up.
Yeah.
So did you travel a lot up until, you said you were working a lot. So did you travel much when you sold the company?
No. I had the lucky benefit of when I was 5 years old, because of my dad's work, we lived in Abingdon, England for a year. And while we were in England, we spent a lot of time in Sicily, Madrid, and Paris.
Nice.
So at the age of five, I grew up in Hinsdale, Illinois, about 25 miles outside of Chicago is kind of where I went to grade school and high school and stuff. So I guess you could say that's most of where I kind of grew up. When I moved from England to Hinsdale, Illinois, even though I considered myself a California kid, I had an English accent from living in England for a year. So I moved to Hinsdale, Illinois, and everybody called me the English kid. I was like, I'm not from England, I'm from California. I was like, Mommy, tell them. Oh God, I hate England. No, I'm from California. And so I guess there's always been at least an awareness that there's a world out there that you could actually live in and not just vacation in. But when you're in America, you feel that you're at the center of everything. Because of whether it's just the Hollywood and the media, just every movie, every TV show, everything is set in America. Everybody has American accents, except for the occasional odd foreign film or something, So you can really kind of
all the aliens invade the United States.
Exactly, that's where they go. They're not invading Uruguay, So you can feel you're at the middle of everything. What's amazing is after leaving culturally And in many ways, America is off at one far extreme of whatever chart you make that goes from, left to right or up to down. America is a very extreme end of things, at one extreme end. It's not the middle. So wait, sorry, I forgot to answer your question. Except for that thing when I was 5 years old, I had not traveled at all. I mean, one thing is I had traveled a lot around the U.S. I lived a few years each in Chicago, Boston, New York, Woodstock, Portland, Oregon, Santa Monica, San Francisco, and Seattle. So I was almost 40 years old, and I had really spent my whole life in the U.S. except for that 1 year when I was five. And so that was a big inspiration for me, is I thought, okay, if I'm on this mission to change the way I think and move ahead in life instead of getting stuck in ruts, especially when you sell a company and it's like, now I'm rich, it's so easy to just get stuck in a rut and be the cliche guy either drinking his margaritas for life or being the sad ex-success, like somebody who had a big hit long ago and now is just stuck in those glory years, the 80s musician trying to do things the 80s way still or whatever. And I wanted to make it impossible for me to get stuck in a rut. So my mission was to spend the rest of my life outside of the U.S., mainly because I loved it too much. Santa Monica in particular, man, Santa Monica, California is a place. When I got to Santa Monica, I just felt, this is it. I've arrived. I love this place. I love these people. I love the food. I love the weather. I love everything.
This is it.
This is where I belong. But that feeling kind of scares me because it's like that thing, when people get to a certain age and say, this is who I am. This is how I like my eggs. This is where I live. I didn't feel it was time to stop progressing, even in my physical location. So my challenge to myself was to live the rest of my life outside the U.S. because I love California too much. I was actually only been in New York City for 3 days. I was passing through for a friend's wedding, and I met this gorgeous girl, and we had this great first date. We were all swooning over each other. And then so on our second date, I had to lay something kind of heavy on her. I said, how would you feel about leaving the U.S. and never coming back? She looked at me for a second and kind of squinted. And she said, yeah, I could do that. And so then we had a third date. And, that's my wife. She's joined me on this mission to spend the rest of our life out of the U.S., even if it's uncomfortable, even if it would just be the easy and comfortable thing to just go back to Santa Monica, to what I know well. It's the idea of kind of forcing yourself to keep progressing. And so far, we've only lived in pretty comfortable places. I mean, we've lived in Singapore for...
one of the most modern places in the world.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody speaks English. You know, she grew up in New York City, so Singapore is another big city. It's very easy and comfortable for her. But, you know, the bigger challenge is the idea of this being a stepping stone to the idea of living somewhere like Brazil or Taiwan, and the idea of staying long enough until even that feels like your comfort zone. Like, can you imagine, like right now, I don't speak Portuguese. I don't know hardly anything about Brazil. But could you imagine what it would do for your life to move down there and put up with some initial discomfort and stay until it becomes your comfort zone, so that Brazil just feels like home and Portuguese is, you've forgotten that it's your second language because it feels like your first and all your friends are there and you get it and the mindset, it feels like your comfort zone. And even better, that once you get to that point, then you do it again. You know, then you go to Taiwan or whatever. And at first it's uncomfortable and it's difficult and then you slowly adapt and then it feels like home. And then you go to Berlin and do it again or whatever.
Yeah, I found that when traveling, I get drawn to comfort zones where expats everywhere. And when you're totally out of your element, like my first trip into Asia, I'm as shiny white as can be. And I was about a good 6 inches taller than everyone around me. And I was just being stared at. You know, I'm riding on a bus in rural Sri Lanka and I'm being stared at and touched and things like that. It was a really weird experience. So that culture shock really drew me to hanging around other travelers, right? Because it felt comfortable. Even though like Americans try to pretend like we're not much like the Europeans, but we're very close. As soon as you travel, you find out just how closely aligned we really are.
Yeah.
And I'm hanging out with Europeans and everything, and I'm thinking, oh man, how cultural of me, right? Where I'm hanging out with a guy from France and a woman from Germany and all this. Yet not hanging out with the people that I actually came to see. So how do you break from that comfort zone when you're traveling?
Well, I think the main difference is to live somewhere instead of traveling somewhere. I mean, you could do it short term, that you could just make yourself talk to people that you're perhaps intimidated by and give the patience to get deeper. You know, like I think whenever you first talk to somebody that's very different from you, like say there's the first thing you notice, of course, is the difference in looks. Like you talked about racism. But I think that the funny thing about racism is that you actually only notice somebody's race for like the first few minutes. And then it just disappears. And then you're just talking to a person. Then somebody, like if you were to say, like somebody were to say, hey, who was that Chinese guy you were talking to? You're like, Chinese guy? Oh, him. Yeah. Like you've almost forgotten their race because
right.
It's just a person, right? And so then to me, the next level is the accent or the language differences. That takes a little longer to get past and go away, to kind of hear through the language barrier and communicate heart to heart despite your missing words or misunderstood vowels. Then you can do that when traveling, like even if you just go somewhere for a week. Say like when I went to India for the first time, at first I was terrified, mostly thanks to a panic-stricken friend of mine who had been there once years ago and right before I left, like warned me that it was the most horrible place on earth and that people were going to be clawing at me and yanking money out of my pockets or whatever. She just like terrified me. So I went there with my guard up fully, right? Like just prepared to be attacked. And I kind of hid at first. Like I hid in my hotel room and I would go on little walks around, but then I'd go back to my hotel room and read a book. And it wasn't until my last week there that I pulled up my CD Baby database and I emailed some musicians that lived in Calcutta. Hey, I'm coming through Calcutta for a week. Would you like to meet up? And until then, I was scared of doing that. You know, I just wanted to be alone. And so I set up like three different meetings with three different musicians from Calcutta. And with each of the three people, we sat around and talked for hours. And unfortunately, it was like my last week there. I wish it was my first week because then I finally got it. Then I kind of felt like
it would have changed your whole experience had it been earlier.
Yeah. And it's like, you know what? They spoke English and yes, they had the accents, but that, you know, that disappears after a while. Like you hear through it after a while. And we were sitting there having a really great heart talk. It's like this bass player from Calcutta and he was telling me about life in Calcutta and the music scene there. And dude, I felt like I was hanging with somebody from Illinois. You know, it just felt as home as anything. And that was only just 1 week there. So now imagine that you live somewhere. So that's one thing to visit, right? So now imagine that you decide to live somewhere, and which is even a self-definition thing. Like, I'm living here versus I'm visiting here. So when people say, where are you from? You say, well, I live here now, but I moved here from the US or something. It's just a different status. But then it's getting to know people deeper, having a circle of friends that you hang out with, and you see each other every week, and you get to know them dearly. And yes, they grew up in a very different environment than you, but you find your common ground. And this to me was the cool thing about, like, so we moved to Singapore 2.5 years ago. It's an interesting hybrid where it has all the modern amenities. It's like, yes, it has drinkable water and fast internet and stuff. And when you visit, it's a very comfortable place to visit. Everything works. It'll feel familiar enough. But man, under the surface, there are some deep worldview differences. And actually, my best friends in Singapore are native Singaporeans. They're very Christian. They're very conservative. And the Asian mindset, it's one thing to have somebody tell you, even in an interview like this, that the Asian mindset is more collective than individualistic. And I've heard that a lot in my life. And I kind of went, yeah, okay, whatever. But to really get to know that mindset and to have people that you know and care about tell you that they chose a profession that they didn't want to do because it was good for the family. And my first reaction as an individualist American is to say, no, that's wrong. Dude, you got to stand up for what you want to do, man. It's what you want to do is important. But to understand that no, that isn't right. That's one way of looking at things. That's that whole thing I was talking about where America is kind of off onto one far end of the spectrum of individualism, is that a lot of the world is much more, values things much more by how good they are for the group. So in Singapore in particular, it's what's good for your country and what's good for your family are the two big things. So only one or two generations ago, most people in Singapore were in poverty. It's really lifted itself out of poverty in just a generation or two. So when the parents say, no, you're not going to be a poet, you're going to get a job you're going to go to a good university and you're going to get a good paying job at a bank. It's kind of non-negotiable because you're expected to take care of your parents. There is no social security that's going to take care of your parents when you're older. It's up to the children to take care of the parents. So if you say, I'm just going to follow my passion and be a poet, you've just told your parents that they might die sooner than they would if you could take care of them well. You know, it affects the whole group. And so you do what's best for the group, not just what's best for you. A little bit like, oh, I thought of a good way to explain this to a friend of mine. A friend of mine was having a hard time understanding this, or it all sounded too high level. And I thought, okay, imagine if you found a car unlocked and the keys were left in it, and somebody were to say, hey, dude, you should totally like steal that car because you can. You'd say, what are you, insane? Like, that's just wrong. Why is that wrong? Because it's bad for society. That's not what you do. That's stealing from someone else. That's like, you have to be a sociopath to think like that. Well, that's the way it's seen to be too individualistic in Asia, is you're seen as somewhat of a sociopath if you say, yeah, well, I want to be a poet, even though my parents want me to be a banker. It's a little bit like stealing a car and driving away. It's just, it's bad for the group. It's bad for everyone. Why would you do this silly idea of following your dreams when you could do the thing that's best for the group? Do you know what I mean?
Right. Oh, yeah. One of my closest friends in university was from Taiwan. And over some drinks, he admitted to me that he was being very selfish. He was dragging out his college education. We were both in architecture school together, and he was dragging it out. So he's like, I really have to graduate within the next couple of years because I have to go back and I have to start adding to the family estate. He's like, I'm the oldest and I'm also a son. So it's like, I have a ton of responsibility on me. So right now I'm kind of leeching off the family right now. And he felt really bad about it. And for me, as an American, I'm like, whatever. Like, why, you know, why would you even think like that? That's insane. And it took me a while of being friends with him for several years to really understand just how much pressure he was under. Because here he is in the United States to get a great education, but also being able to look around and say, you know, if I just stayed here, my life would be amazing. But instead, he knew he was going back to Taiwan and do his duty to his entire family. And, you know, I had huge, huge respect for the guy by the time we finished school. I understood exactly where he was coming from and why it was important for him to go back and do what his family wanted, even though he wanted something else that he could have got in the U.S.
Yes. And what's so hard to get over as an American is to not think that that's wrong. You know,
right.
I find myself, even right now when we're talking about it, I'm
cringing,
still feeling like that's wrong. He should stand up for himself and do what is best for him. I'm like, no, hold on. That's my American roots. Like that's just one way of looking at things. That's my American point of view. And speaking of, by the way, like my whole like mission to never live in the US again, it's because I feel like I'm already about American as I can possibly be. Like, I get it. I've lived in whatever, five corners of America, and it's true. I haven't lived in Mississippi or Montana yet, but for the most part, I get it. I get America about as much as anyone can. And now it's time to kind of like push out of that. So it's still hard for me to get over my American way of looking things. And what's so cool is to have like dear friends now that are the opposite, that when I talk about my individualistic things, they cringe because they grew up in India or Singapore. And for them, it's so hard to get over the fact that feeling that individualism and following your passion and all that is wrong, you know? So it's so cool to just like be really close with somebody that sees it from the other point of view.
So the time you spent in Singapore, because I read your recent post about global thinking versus local thinking, and you had decided you were going to really think local in Singapore. Was this business or music focused, or was it a little more holistic?
It was holistic. It was just everything. It was entirely like, I live here now. I'm a permanent resident of Singapore. It's the equivalent of getting like the green card in the U.S. Like I got permanent residency in Singapore. I am now a permanent resident of Singapore. Might even get citizenship and all that someday. I'm here. So I want to get to know my community. I want to be a part of the community and just immerse myself totally. And yeah, for the last 2 years, I've been totally immersed into the community of Singapore, mostly just giving in every way I can. Like I was immediately upon moving to Singapore, I was tapped by every university and group and hackerspace and everything to come speak to our group, come speak to our class, come speak to this, come speak here. So I did a lot of speaking, a lot of mentoring, also a lot of meeting. I had hundreds of one-on-one meetings. I've spent, I don't know, a few thousand hours of the last couple of years just sitting down one-on-one with people and mostly just like letting them pick my brain. It's always somebody else initiating it saying, I'd really like to meet with you. I have this idea for a business or something, or I just want to meet with you. Can I pick your brain? And I'd just always say yes, because it's like, well, this is my new home. So yes. Yeah, I did really most of the last 2 years. Online, I appear to be pretty silent. People ask me like, hey, dude, I haven't seen a new blog post from you in 4 months or whatever. But it's because, you know, every day for whatever, 6-something, 8 hours a day, I'm kind of giving to my local community here and meeting with everybody that wants to meet with me and letting everyone pick my brain and speaking it to every group that asks me to speak. And I think I finally had to admit slowly to myself that it was very one-sided. Not 100% one-sided, but I definitely got something out of it, because with every person I speak to, of course, I learn something as well. But just the nature of the conversations, not quite as lopsided as this one, where it was clear, like you said, can I interview you? You know, that's designed to be a lopsided conversation. But, you know, sometimes they were almost this lopsided. It was like people who had a bunch of questions that they wanted to ask me or wanted to ask questions about what I had learned in life or from experience or whatever. And so I would do most of the talking, unfortunately. But I would learn a little something about Singapore or about their mindset. For the most part, it felt like what I really need to do in my life right now is get back to the idea that I paused for, God, almost 5 years ago now, that monk work idea that I was describing, it's still gnawing at me. I still think it's worth doing. The company idea that I had the day after I sold CD Baby, I still want to do it. And it's been on hold for 5 years and it's been gnawing at me. I really think that I need to stop doing all this one-on-one meeting and I need to just focus on my work. And around this time, I read a few books that really helped speak to that feeling. The author's name is Stephen Pressfield, and he's written three different books. I think one's called Do the Work. One is called The War of Art. And his new one is Turning Pro, I think it's called. And all three of them, they're kind of almost like three in a series, speaking to the same thing. He's a novelist and a screenwriter, and he calls it the resistance, that feeling like when you're sitting down, and he says like facing your demons and like forcing yourself to like try to like sit in that chair, even though everything in you just wants to like get up and grab a snack or take a nap or watch TV or call a friend. But no, like you need to sit in that chair and wrestle through this difficult paragraph or chapter or idea or whatever it is. And looking at it in that new light, it really, really resonated with me. Like sometimes if you're reading something, like you hear some new bit of information and you go, that's interesting. I never thought about it that way before. And other things you hear and they just hit you in the gut. Like, yeah, that is something I've known and felt all along and just never put into words before.
Because you were resisting it.
Yes. And so, dude, for 5 years now, for just something just under 5 years, like that's why, you know, I told you earlier on like this idea of how I had that company idea the day after I sold CD Baby and I spent a few months on it, but then I halted. And what's kind of crazy is that we spent most of this conversation glorifying the world traveler, nomadic, adventure-seeking culture, rebooting my operating system kind of life. But what's kind of crazy is to look at that all again through a different lens now and say, that was all resistance against just what I really needed to be doing was to like shut up, sit down, and get back to the really difficult work of creating something and like struggling through that painful resistance of making it happen instead of just leaping off to another country and learning another culture and having another conversation with another stranger. The really difficult work can be to shut up, sit down, and do your work. And so that's where I'm at right now.
Okay, Derek, so you've been battling this resistance, this traveling, this getting into new cultures. You're saying it was mostly resistance. So what's that going to do now? Like, how is that actually informed what you're doing right now?
Well, I think there's some things you have to work through. Like you just said that traveling inspires you and all that and helps you be more creative. And it's true that all of this world traveling has opened my mind to many things. And there's so much more to go. I feel like I've just barely begun. I mean, I haven't yet been to so many countries that I still can't wait to understand more about. So I feel like I'm just beginning. But most minimalists you'll meet are people that used to have too much stuff. And they were pack rats or they were shopping freaks or whatever, and they got too much stuff. And then they felt the pain of having too much stuff. And then they got rid of it and felt the greater joy of realizing that you don't need that stuff, right? So I feel that way culturally. Like the last few years, I've just been like binging on the culture of the world and just not in a leisurely way. It's actually been in a very like focused working kind of way. In fact, one of my first projects that I'm going to be launching soon is for the last year, I've been producing 16 books about doing business in Asia, about 16 different countries in Asia. So it's the Entrepreneur's Guide to Sri Lanka, the Entrepreneur's Guide to Taiwan, the Entrepreneur's Guide to Mongolia. And I've been to most of these countries and interviewed tons of people and gathered all this research and hired researchers and all this stuff. So I've been really binging on the cultures of the world. And now that I've been through that, I felt the pain of not having created anything. And that's what it took for me to get back to the point where it's like, yeah, I could go to yet another country and meet yet another stranger and learn more about that. But I need to sit down and program. I want to make Muckwork happen. I have another idea called Song Test, which is like an open source song feedback contest kind of thing. I have an idea called Cyrano. It's kind of a like Cyrano de Bergerac tweet for me kind of thing for people who don't want to tweet for themselves. I want to sit down and make that happen. Each one of these things, the way to make it happen is to sit down and focus for a few weeks or a few months and launch it. And then maybe lift my head up again, but probably even keep my head down for a couple of years and follow through and make, you know, get some momentum for it and make it something that rolls on its own. Like that's the hard work that I need to do next. And it makes the question of where to do it becomes moot, you know, because the focus is inward again instead of outward. Right. So I could sit in my apartment in Singapore. I could rent a vacation home in New Zealand. I could, the funny thing is I'm still banning myself from going back to the US for now. It's still too familiar to me, too much my comfort zone still. Like, even though I'm inward focused, I'd almost rather still be in Brazil or India or Sweden or, you know, anywhere else.
Right.
So we're talking from New Zealand right now, or I'm in New Zealand right now. I'm down here for a couple months, and one thing I like about New Zealand is it's so far away from everything that it's kind of like the antidote to the travel bug. Because when I'm in Singapore, there are so many fascinating cultures, like 1 hour away.
A little hop on the plane, right?
Yes, and not only that, but like with a discount airfare, it's like $65 and I can be in Bali or Thailand or Cambodia or Malaysia or Borneo. And it's like, ah, it's all right there. It's so tempting. And so I rented a little vacation place for a few months down in New Zealand to kind of come here and fight the travel bug and stay focused. So that's what I'm doing right now.
I want to jump on, because we've been talking, just kind of BSing here for a long time. And one of the things that I really liked that you said was that you hadn't created, that you spent this time. And I think a lot of people have this hollow feeling in themselves where they know they could be creating. And some of them even attempt to do it through business, but it doesn't transfer. They fall prey to resistance. They don't actually get it done. And that hollowness really, really ends up tainting their own worldview. So how do you take that hollowness that you felt of not creating and turn it around and actually make something from it?
It's just that the do the work thing. It's shut up, sit down, fight the temptation to do other things, to follow your distractions, and just work. Like, most of us know what we need to do. That's what's crazy. I think, like, in any field, in any person, what you need to do is usually painfully obvious. We're all searching for distractions or reading yet another book with yet some more advice. But no, we've heard enough advice. We've all got enough advice. Really, what you need to do, you already know what you need to do. It's different for everybody. For me, it's programming. Like, in order for all of my ideas to happen, it has to start with the website. To me, business is still art. It's something that I create as a personal expression of something that I want to exist. And so the idea of, like, saying we'll just hire somebody to program it is a little bit like telling the songwriter in the band to just hire somebody to write the songs for them. It's like, well, no, this is what I do. This is my art. I want to write the songs. So I still want to program my websites, my ideas. I've never learned JavaScript before, and talking about changing my operating system, I've been doing nothing but PHP for 10 years, then learning Rails, and I'd never touched JavaScript. It always was kind of a silly decoration until a few years ago. It always felt a little like unnecessary flourishes, and now it's really become more core. So I'm like, okay, I picked up a 1,200-page book on that everybody says is the best way to learn JavaScript, and I'm going through it chapter by chapter, jotting down everything I'm learning into flashcards and memorizing it all and spending hours a day just making little exercises for myself and learning JavaScript with the idea of applying it to programming those ideas I was talking about. So, yeah, for me, how do I combat that emptiness of feeling is to just... It's just willpower. It's it's almost like meditation, man. It's, you know, when, again, it's like I'm no Buddhist, but when you learn about meditation, the first thing you hear is that, yes, all of these distractions come into your head and you'll be sitting there trying to stay silent and focused. And all of a sudden you'll think about something that somebody told you yesterday. And you have to just learn to let it go, to kind of say, okay, that's just a distraction. I can let that go now. And to let it run back out of your head instead of doing something about it. And I think that that's the problem of our kind of always on, always connected internet thing, is that a lot of us, like all day long, as soon as you have any kind of whimsy or curiosity or thought in your head, you immediately just type a Google query or go search something or go check on something, or let me just see how my friends are doing. Let me check in. Let me make sure I'm not missing anything. Let me go look at Hacker News or whatever. And it's like meditation, feeling that urge and just going like, hello, urge. I'm not going to acknowledge you. I'm busy. Go away. And to just let it go and to not act on it, I think is the biggest challenge for me right now.
Very cool. Very cool. So any final words of wisdom you can give everybody listening? You know, we've talked about mostly just a philosophical discussion and, you know, giving them just a little bit of what not to do. What can they do? What would you say to people that are ingrained in their life, in their culture, in their rut, but want something different out of life? What can you say to them?
Well, if you're feeling in a rut, I mean, there are two ways out of it. And we've talked about both of them here, that sometimes what you need to do is to change everything, to just quit your job, move somewhere different. If you're stuck in a bad relationship, get out of it. If you've been with somebody for too many years and it's a bad relationship, then get out of it and go be single. If you've been single for too many years, well, then commit. you know, if you've been doing things one way for too long, do the opposite. But then the other way out of a rut, the last thing we just mentioned, is to finally have the willpower and discipline to do the thing that you've been avoiding all these years. You know what you need to do to understand that you really need to do it now, that your life is going to get worse and worse and worse if you don't act on what you know you should be doing. And for some people, that means starting a company. For some people, it means joining a company. For some people, it means making calls that they've been scared to make, or, I don't know, confronting their parents about something, whatever it is. Like, it's usually the difficult, often long thing. Yeah, it's too tempting to say that it's going to be a short fix. Like, hey, just make that call that you've been meaning to make. No, you need to learn that programming language that you've been meaning to learn. And it's going to take you a year. You know, it can often be that really long, hard, difficult thing. How about like changing your eating habits? You've been eating crap. You need to start eating mostly vegetables. And it's going to be hard. Sometimes I felt like when I was living a kind of travel adventures and jumping off to new countries and meeting strangers, I often felt that what I was doing was very good for other people. That other people could say, wow, that looks so fun. What an adventure. Whereas like telling people that, like, no, I need to say no to the 20 people a week that want to meet with me, and say no to the many conferences that want me to come, and say no to all the projects people are asking me to join. And I need to say no to everything. And I need to sit here and spend 6 hours a day programming and 3 hours a day writing. And
oh, but that's not glamorous.
Right. It's not glamorous. It's not interesting to others.
Right.
But it's what needs to be done. It's the more difficult thing. But so only you know which of these two paths is your path out of a rut. And it's really tempting to think it's the exciting quick fix adventure thing of hopping on a plane and quitting your job and breaking up your relationship. And, you know, that's fun, but be really honest with yourself that maybe, you know, the thing to get you out of your rut is finally acting on the thing that you have been avoiding for years.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Derek, it's been a pleasure. I am very happy to have been able to sit down and just chat with you for a while and kind of get your philosophical view on the world and how that informs our business decisions. And
I don't know how much of any of this refers back to business. I mean,
well, I think it does. I think everything we do in our lives, there's no separation. And I use the word business just to be able to say that there is this artificial separation. But what we do in our business is a part of our lives. It's an act of creation. It's an act of, as you said, art. You can't separate the art from the artist. And that's why I love these kind of philosophical mindset discussions. Yeah, they're not, you can't just go and, oh, I just listened to Derek for an hour and now I can go and succeed in business. That's not what it's for. What it's for is to, as you said in the very beginning, you know, change your operating system, put a new program in there. And that new program right. in time could be the thing that actually helps you out in your business goals.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, the one thing I didn't emphasize enough is the importance of reading books, not just scanning articles. If you think about how many hours and hours you spend like skimming articles and reading the news and just that quick fix kind of stuff. And if instead, can you imagine if you didn't do that, but instead you put aside like 2 hours a day to pick up some books that are speak to something that you either don't know anything about, like architecture or whatever, or to make you a deeper expert in something, in an issue that you really care about. So often you learn so much more from that than you would just skimming around. The idea of like thinking something through deeper and then putting aside time to reflect on your own. It's one thing to just sit and read and read and read and read. Sometimes you need to put aside an hour and a half to write your own thoughts about it and have it internalize it instead of just taking it in and moving on, you know. But, yeah, you're right. So it's inseparable, this whole business and personal thing. And it's funny sometimes when people would want to pick my brain about their business and they'd say, "Here's my business idea. What do you think?" I'd be like, "I don't know. What kind of person are you?" Like, it depends. Like, do you want something stable? Are you looking to get bought? Are you looking to have an adventure? You know, it's like, depends on who the person is. You can't just say, "This is my business advice," until you know who the person is you're speaking to.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Thanks for mentioning that it's inseparable.
Again, I really appreciate it. And I know you've got to get your head back down and back to work.
Yeah.
And I need to do the same over here. So same thing with all the listeners. I want you to go out and after you've taken some time and reflected on your life and put your head down.
And enjoy your foolish adventure.
You've just listened to the Foolish Adventure Show with Tim Conley. To get more straight talk about making money online and building a successful internet business, go to foolishadventure.com. There, you can opt into the Freedom File newsletter. You'll also get access to the Foolish Guide to Launching Products video training module, over an hour and 20 minutes of business building knowledge that can generate tens of thousands of dollars for your new product. Enjoy your Foolish Adventure.